Okay, and it's 6 o'clock here in Israel. I believe 11 o'clock the East Coast in Toronto, I think. Good to see you, everybody. Good to see familiar faces and names, and new faces and names. Rabbi Kalman will rejoin us soon, so I will just start by myself here. I just want to apologize in advance. I already told Rabbi Kalman, I'm telling you now. I hurt my leg and I'm on strong painkillers, which should not really interfere with the class, but you never know. You never know when you start if there's going to be any effect or not. So I apologize in advance if at some point I need to pause for a second and catch my breath and get going. And on this note, let's delve right in. Last week we discussed the first covenantal family. We discussed Abraham Avinu, Sarah Imenu, and there are many, many complicated relationships. And it was a little bit of an overwhelming session, I felt, because we were trying to squeeze in so many different layers of one man's relationships. Abraham's relationship with God, Abraham's relationship with his father, with his sons, with his wife, with his concubine, with his followers, with other people in the world. And moving forward, we're going to keep pulling back on some of those threads, some of the things we opened up when we discussed Abraham, and give ourselves a little bit more time to unpack them and kind of chew them up a bit more and really see what we can get from them when we watch those motifs or themes or types of relationships play a role in his children's and grandchildren's and great-grandchildren's lives as we move forward with the book of Genesis. Because now we're no longer talking about some general humanity, about people from here and people from there. Now we're really zooming in to the family that Abraham started and all its many tribulations and trial moving forward. So without further introductions, let's go straight in. And the relationship I want to discuss today is the relationship between Abraham's son, Yitzchak, and his wife, Rivka. And this is a relationship that in my own personal history played a very alienating role. I'm going to share with you something personal here, just to make my point. When I was a kid growing up in a religious Zionist environment and going to religious Zionist schools, my teachers kept bringing the example of Isaac and Rebecca, Yitzchak and Rivka, as a way to hammer it into our impressionable teenager heads, that love can and should come after marriage. Because in the Bible, when we hear about Isaac and Rebecca, we don't hear about people meeting and coming to love one another on their own. We're rather reading about a very much arranged marriage. And an arranged marriage in which Yitzchak himself plays a very passive role. If you recall, the marriage is arranged by Abraham without any consultation with Isaac. After, sorry. After Sarah's death, Abraham decides it's time to take care of his son's future, and he sends his slave, Eliezer, to the land where his brother, his remaining brother, lived in Haran across the Jordan River to find a wife for his son, Yitzhak. And he makes the slave swear that he shall not marry, shall not bring a local girl for Yitzhak. Yitzhak must marry back into the extended family rather than marry one of the nations living around them and dilute his commitment to Abraham's covenant with God. And then Eliezer heads out, sits by a well, wonders what he has to do, how to find the right girl, and he makes this bargain or makes this offer to God. He says, whichever girl comes to the well, I'll ask her, can you give me some water? And the girl who says, of course, I'll give you and your camels water, winner. That's the one. And of course, Rebecca, Isaac's cousin, comes, says, I'll give water to your camels as well, runs back and forth with great energy, gives water to all the camels, reveals her identity as Abraham's relative when the slave asks her for her name. The slave goes into her household, brokers the marriage, and brings her home to Isaac. throughout this entire long passage of narrative, Isaac has no voice. Isaac has no presence. Isaac is not an involved party in any way. The story is moved first by Abraham, then by the slave, then by Lavan and Nachor, Rebecca's male relatives, and eventually by Rebecca herself, who is the one to go and give water to the camels and prove her suitability, and then is asked by her male relatives if she is willing to go and marry Yitzchak and says, yes, I shall go and marry him. Yitzchak himself is not part of the story. Only after Isaac and Rebecca are brought together do we hear that Isaac came to love Rebecca, which is relevant. It is an important distinction, seeing as this is the first time in the entire Hebrew Bible where we hear that a man loves his wife. The first time, as we mentioned last week, the first time we ever hear that anybody loves anyone with the word ohev, ahava, the word for love in Hebrew, was when we heard that Abraham loves Isaac in the very moment when God tells him, take the son whom you love and sacrifice him. Now we hear not about Isaac being loved, we hear about Isaac loving, and for the first time we see romantic of sorts love between, or one-sided love, we don't know what Rebecca feels, in a married couple. So all my teachers said, yeah, you see, you can have romantic love in an arranged marriage. You shouldn't go and date kids in the center of town and just look for handsome boys in the bus station or whatever it is you crazy teenage girls want to do. No, no, no. You should marry whoever your family chooses for you and it'll be fine. You'll find love. Look at Isaac and Rebecca. That was at least how their exhortations sounded to us. I'm sure that we as teenage girls added some drama to it that wasn't necessarily there. But coming to this story of Isaac and Rebecca and their relationship as an adult, I found that despite all my negative emotions and my negative expectations and all the baggage I carried looking at the story, I couldn't deny that the formation of this relationship, the scene where Isaac and Rebecca finally meet, form a union, and Isaac comes to love Rebecca, is a key scene in the entire story of the book of Genesis. And it's a key scene because within this one scene, three things change. Let's read the scene together and then I'll point out the changes. A moment. Here I am. I'm in box two. If you have a sheet in some other format, I'll read it in the English. You have the Hebrew ahead of you. Then Rebekah and her maids arose, mounted the camels, and followed the man. The man is the slave. So the servant, or slave in Hebrew, took Rebekah and went his way. Isaac had just come back from the vicinity of Be'er Lechai Ro'i, for he was settled in the region of the Negev. And Isaac went out walking in the field. In Hebrew it says, Lasuach basadeh, which the commentators are not so clear what it means. Some of them say it's walking. Some of them say it's conversing. He was conversing with his workers. And some say conversing with God, that he was praying. And the Midrash even says, the sages even say, that this was when he created Mincha, the afternoon prayer. But anyway, he's doing something in the field towards evening. And looking up, he saw camels approaching. Raising her eyes, Rebecca saw Isaac. She alighted from the camel and said to the servant, in Hebrew, it doesn't say alight. She said she fell off the camel. Who is that man walking in the field towards us? And the servant said, that is my master. So she took her veil and covered herself. The servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Isaac then brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah, and he took Rebecca as his wife. Isaac loved her and thus found comfort after his mother's death. It's a very short scene, all of few verses. And yet within this one scene, three dramatic changes occur. The first change is in Isaac himself. Until this scene, Isaac is a vessel in other people's plans. He is the son who is bound on a mountain. He is the son for whom people pray or make promises or banish a brother out of the household. He is a son whose own marriage is arranged through other people's initiative and involvement. Following this scene, with a short passage only dedicated to Abraham's late years and death, we watch Isaac rising as an active man in his own right, making his own decisions, pursuing activities, making choices, making political pacts. And the first moment like that that we see, the first real choice that we see him making, that's his own on some deep way, is the choice he made at the very end of this passage when he brings Rebecca to the tent of his mother, Sarah. Taking Rebecca as his wife is prescribed by other people, by his father's decree, by the slave's choice, by Rebecca's will. But where he's taking her, that's his choice. And as we will see later today, this is significant. The location is very important. And something about it allows him to change and become an active character in his own right. But it's not only that this scene and this encounter with Rebecca changes Yitzchak from a passive vessel in other people's plans to an actor in his own right. The focus of the narrative, the focus of the biblical narrative changes. Until this point, the hero of the story is very much Abraham. For quite a few chapters, it's Abraham's struggles, Abraham's trials, Abraham's will and covenant and relationship with God that set the tone and are constantly at the focus. Every now and then, the narrative strays. It describes to us what's happening in Sodom and Gomorrah when Lot is there and it's being ruined, for example. It's describing to us the birth of Rebecca in faraway land. But those excursions are very much in the service of the general narrative that's focused on Abraham and his relatives and family in life. Other than that little passage following the verses we read together that deals with Abraham's death, from now on, the focus of the narrative is shifting to Yitzchak. Not only is Yitzchak as a character, as a person, becoming a more active one, but the narrative as such shifts its perspective to follow what Isaac is about to do next. Both of these are within the realms of storytelling. We look at the structure of the story and we can see these changes take place. But there's yet another change, and it's in a sense a much deeper and bigger one. It's a philosophical one. But to understand that, we have to take another step back and look at what's happening in this scene. What does it mean that the story changes focus to Isaac? What does it mean that Isaac rises to be a man in his own right? It means that Abraham's covenant with God stops being one man's relationship with his creator, and becomes that which can be bequeathed and passed on from generation to generation to generation. Because it is only when Isaac stands up on his own two feet and chooses to continue his father's path that we can even talk about Abrahamic path going onwards into history. It's only when Isaac continues the terms of a covenant, enjoys the benefits of the promise, and continues to serve God faithfully and follow God's instructions, that we can talk about the covenant as something that is not just one bright flare in history, but rather a legacy, a way of life, something that we here millennia later still find a relevant and empowering thing that we can take from others and pass on. So we see these shifts happening right here. The shift in Isaac the man or the character. We see the shift in the focus of the narrative. And we see this deep shift, this deep transformation of the covenant into something that can move and outlast Abraham's personal life and his ultimate death. But what is it about this small scene, so few verses, so few events, that enables these stories to happen? We could say it's just random. You know, those changes had to happen. So this scene just happens to be the axis moment when things turn. But the biblical text, it doesn't work this way, especially in the Torah and the five books of Moses. Every word is very carefully calculated. Every scene is carefully calibrated to fit into a bigger whole. So we can't just dismiss the question and say, oh, well, some scene had to be the turning scene, so why not this one? No, something about this scene enables all those changes or allows them to happen. And as we delve into this scene and start taking it apart and looking at what it tells us, we will have this question, the question of what about this scene liberates or unlocks those changes in Isaac, in the focus of the story, and in the meaning of the covenant itself, and makes them possible. Now, one thing about the scene that is worth noting from the get-go is that it really marks the beginning of a relationship. Sometimes in the Bible, we don't get the beginnings of relationships. For example, Abraham and Sarah walk into the story together. We don't know why Abraham chose to marry her, what they felt towards each other before God called upon Abraham and was then Abraham, of course, and told him, go forth to a land which I will show you. We don't know. Only few relationships get the highlight from the very beginning. So what we see here is the beginning of a story of a relationship. And when we look at the beginning of any story, any well-crafted story, we can look, if we look carefully, we can find the ways in which the author of the story, divine or otherwise, is setting up certain expectations, is creating within us certain expectations regarding how the story will continue, where it should go on. And these expectations become like little flashlights that we carry with us as we move forward in the story. And then we use them, or they draw our attention to places where we should notice things, where we should be especially surprised or especially not surprised by something taking place, thus helping us turn the story from just a pile of events and characters into something with a structure and tension and an arc. So when we look at this scene that we just read together, we're not only looking at yet another scene. We're looking for clues that the biblical storyteller infused in here, in these verses, to help us pay attention to what's going to be important about the relationship between Isaac and Rebecca. So this is what we're going to do now. We're going to look for these clues. And the first clue lies before anybody does or says anything, really. The first clue lies in the setting of the story. When we enter the story, when we enter the scene, Isaac is associated with two places. Let's look at it again together. I'm in verse 62. Isaac has just come back from the vicinity of Be'er Lechai Ro'i, a particular well, the well called Lechai Ro'i, and he is walking in a field. Now, the most recent time that a field was mentioned in the biblical text immediately preceding this scene was in the moment of Sarah's burial. Sarah was buried in the cave, but is in a field. I am going to skip ahead a little bit to the bottom of box number 3. And then Abraham buried his wife Sarah in the cave of the field of Machpelah, facing Mamre, now Hebron, in the land of Canaan. Since in this scene, we hear in the scene we're talking about, Isaac and Rebecca's first encounter, we end the scene with words that imply that until this point, Isaac was not comforted after his mother's death, preoccupied with his mother's death. Let's look at the bottom here in verse 67. After he takes Rebecca as his wife, Isaac loved her and thus found comfort after his mother's death. So since this is the ending of the scene, it's very telling that the beginning of the scene uses the word field, sadeh, to place him, to anchor Isaac in the kind of perspective that we're looking at, not perspective, prospect or view that we're looking at as we watch the scene unfold. But it's not only that he's preoccupied, perhaps, with his mother's death, with his maternal loss. The well also marks him as preoccupied with events in the past that had to do with his family. Because this well, the Er Lechai Ro'i, as we mentioned in last week's session, is the place where his father's concubine, Hagar, received an oracle from an angel who promised her that the baby in her womb is going to be healthy and alive, and his name will be Ishmael, and he will found a great nation. In other words, the place where Isaac dwells, the place where he's coming back from at this particular scene, is a well that is tied to a prophecy that is tied to his lost brother, the brother that was banished and taken apart. According to the sages, he was not just hanging out by this well, he was actually going to visit his brother. What's important to us for this, for the purposes of looking at these two characters and what happens between them, it's interesting to know that both field and well mark Isaac as somehow preoccupied with his familial past, with his past relationships. Now let's look where Rebecca is in the tableau we're examining. Rebecca is sitting on the camels. She is riding a camel into the scene. And then she falls off the camel. The camel is clearly central. This is how she rides in. As we hear in the beginning, that she and her maids mounted the camels and followed the men. Then it's the scene of her very dramatic falling off when we hear, just a moment, alighted from the camel, v'tipol me'al ha'gamal. And just as the well and the field have a certain resonance in the Isaac story, the camel has a very strong resonance in the Rebecca story, because the camels are the same camels that were used to test her once seen earlier by a different well to prove her suitability to be Isaac's bride. It was the camels that she offered water to. It was the camels that she didn't simply offer water to, that she rushed and exerted herself to offer water to fast and well and extensively. And by the way, the word gamal in Hebrew, camel, gamal, is related to a different word, to gomelet chasadim, someone who makes acts of loving kindness. In the very act of watering the camels, of drawing and offering water to the camels, Rebecca proved her character trait, or her dedication to being the kind of person who is gomel chasadim, someone who is dedicated to doing acts of loving kindness. Does that remind you of someone else? It's very reminiscent of her father-in-law, for example. If you look at a different scene here, just a moment. If you look at the verbs, sorry, I'm at box five. The verbs that are used in the scene where she offers water to the camels, they're very strong verbs. For example, in verse 17, we hear that the servant ran. There's a certain feeling of quickness, of excitement. Then she quickly lowered her jar to let him drink. Then she again quickly emptied her jar. Then she ran to the well, etc., etc. And when he told her that he needs a place to stay, she immediately extends hospitality. There is plenty of straw and feed at home, and also room to spend the night. And then she runs one last time at the end here. The maiden ran and told all of this to her mother's household. All of these verbs, all of this jumping to the act of offering hospitality, are extremely reminiscent to Abraham's response when the three angels visit him. If you look at box number six, looking up, he saw three men standing near him. As soon as he saw them, he ran from the entrance of the tent to greet them. And bowing to the ground, he said, "My lords, if it please you, do not go on past your servant." And then he goes and offers them food. And again, Abraham, I'm jumping ahead to verse six, hastened into the tent to Sarah and said, "Quick, three se'ahs of choice flour, knead and make cakes." So when we see Rebecca rushing and rushing and rushing, what we see is her behaving in an Abraham-like way. And when we see her on the camels riding into the scene where she meets Isaac for the first time, what we see is a powerful visual reminder of what made her be chosen for this job. And what made her be chosen was her extreme initiative, her extreme kindness, her extreme hospitality, her extreme Abraham-like characteristics. And yet it's even more than that. There's another thing about Rebecca that is very reminiscent of Abraham. Because unlike many other women in the Bible, Rebecca had a say in her own marriage, unlike her husband, by the way. When it was time for her to leave, her brother and father said, let's ask the girl if she actually wants to go, if she's willing to go. And Rebecca says, I am again in box number 6. I am jumping to verse 58. They called Rebecca and said to her, will you go with this man? And she said, I will. Except in Hebrew, she didn't say, I will. She said, Elech, I shall go. Which echoes the Lech Lecha, the go forth, that Abraham heard from God before setting out on his own journey from the same place, leaving the same family members behind. Just like Abraham one generation earlier, Rebecca hears some sort of calling and follows it, leaving behind her family, leaving behind the house she grew up with, leaving her father, and pursuing a different future. Now, her calling is not God saying, go forth. Her calling that she hears is a marriage proposition that she wants to accept. But that act, the act of leaving the past behind and pursuing boldly a new future, is once more Avraham-like. And present in the scene when we watch her riding the camel, because the camel are the vehicle not only of her test of initiative and kindness and loving kindness and chesed, but also of her journey into the unknown, her journey away from everything she knew before. And now let's look at it together, and we shall see that just the setting of the story, just the placement of Isaac on one side and Rebecca on another side within the tableau of their first encounter already tells us two things. It tells us that on some deep level, here are profoundly different people. A man who is preoccupied with his familial past, with his mother, with his brother, and a woman who is forging into the future. And furthermore, a woman who on some level echoes not Yitzhak, not passive Yitzhak, who is a vessel in other people's plans, who wasn't even there at his own betrothal scene a few verses earlier, but rather her father-in-law, Avraham. So this is the settings. Let's see what else the text shows us. The text goes on to create another parallel or a comparison or a contrast between Isaac and Rebecca by describing both of them as raising their eyes and seeing. Let's see it in the scene. Raising their eyes and seeing. First, Isaac, in verse 63, looking up, he saw camels approaching. Except in Hebrew, it doesn't say looking up. It says, Va'isa enavaya. And he raised an eyes and saw. This formula, and he raised his eyes and saw, is a formula that repeats itself in biblical stories and is always followed not just by, oh, and he saw a flower on the side of the road or something incidental. It's followed by something significant, something important, something that shapes things to come, that can tell us something about the characters involved. If you look at box, just a moment. If you look down at box 7, I brought several examples like this. For example, we see, I'll jump to the second example. When Abraham sees the angels looking up, right, he raised his eyes and saw 3 men standing near him. That's when the angels came to tell him about the birth of Isaac. Then when he leads Yitzhak to the binding of Yitzhak, to the sacrifice of Yitzhak, as Abraham sees it, or we think he sees it, we hear on the third day, Abraham looked up and saw, raised his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then after God, the angel, tells him not to kill Isaac, Abraham raised his eyes and saw a ram caught in the thicket by its horns. Time and time again, raising your eyes marks a significant scene. And in our scene, Isaac raises his eyes and sees. And later, Rebecca, in verse 64, raising her eyes, Rebecca saw Isaac. Except it doesn't say raising his eyes. It says, and she raised her eyes and saw. The same formula as before. So two verses, one immediately after the other, are drawing our attention to the fact that Isaac and Rebecca are doing the same thing. But this similarity only draws our attention to the difference in what they see. Isaac looks up, and what does he see? Camels approaching. Not a caravan, not his father's camels, not his father's slave, not his future wife, not any of those things that describe the context, the meaning of this phenomena that's clopping towards him. No, what he sees is the camels. Does that mean that he sees reality without seeing its human context, that he just kind of sees a bucolic scenery, just what's there, without looking for meanings? Does that mean the opposite, that he looks for the symbolic meaning of things, of what it means when we hear that he sees the camels is all the things that the camels symbolize for Rebecca, her loving kindness, or Abraham-like willingness to leave behind her country and her family and go forth? We don't know. And perhaps that's the most telling thing, that we don't understand what Isaac sees. We don't understand the meaning of what Isaac sees. We don't have almost ever an insight into what's going on inside Isaac throughout his story. He is opaque to us. We see the intentions of the people around him, but we don't know what's going on inside him. What Rebecca sees is much more straightforward. She looks up and she sees Yitzhak. She sees this particular man. And she doesn't know yet who he is, but she sees him and she immediately knows he's significant. And then the real difference begins. Because the real difference is not only in what they see or don't see. The real difference is what they do after they see whatever it is that they see. Let's look first at Rebecca. When Rebecca sees Yitzhak, she does the following. She alighted from the camel or fell off the camel. She, and I'm counting the verbs, she said to the servant, who is this man walking in the field towards us? After he tells her, that is my master, she takes her veil, in Hebrew, vatikach, vatitkas, and covers herself. Four verbs, one immediately after the other, in two verses. She responds. And this stands in a sharp contrast to Isaac. Because what does Isaac do when he raises his eyes and sees Rebecca? Nothing. We have no idea what he does. As far as the story goes, he does absolutely nothing. Let's reread verse 63. And Isaac went out walking in the field toward evening, and looking up, he saw camels approaching. That's it. Then we move straight to Rebecca. In fact, even by the time the camels come closer to Isaac, he doesn't act. He only acts after the slave talks to him. The servant told Isaac all the thing that he had done. And then for the first time, we see Isaac taking action. Isaac then brought her into the tent of his mother, Sarah, and he took Rebecca as his wife. Isaac loved her and thus found comfort after his mother's death. Excuse me. What we see here is that through every layer of the storytelling here, from setting to what the characters see and what it tells us about them, and eventually to their own actions, the biblical storyteller is hammering it down our throats that Isaac and Rebecca are extremely different, almost mirror images of one another. Isaac is passive, in some ways absent. He was absent from the previous scene, the betrothal scene, and now even in this scene, his input is absent. We don't know what he thinks. We don't see him responding like we see Rebecca responding. Whereas Rebecca is active, taking initiative, associated with a lot of verbs, a lot of responses. By the way, just as an aside, this particular trait of Rebecca, the way we see her constantly described with all these verbs, all these instances of taking initiative, her son, who will be her less beloved son, Esav, will actually inherit that particular characteristic. It's kind of interesting and unexpected. If you look, sorry, I have to find it again in the source sheet. If you look at, here, I'm in box number 9, the second source, a scene that we just read in last week's Parsha, this week. Jacob then gave Esav bread and lentil stew. He, that is Esav, ate and drank, and he rose, and he went away. Thus did Esav spurn the birthright. Which, ironically, shapes Esav as alike the mother he has less of a relationship with, who also later in the story, not only in this opening scene, constantly shows initiative, taking into her own hands the situation with the blessings, taking into her own hands her perplexity about her own pregnancy and going to look for answers. Time and time again, we see her taking initiative, and we will see Esav do the same. But we will talk more about that next week. This was really just as an aside. The question that rises for me when I see how methodically the text shapes this contrast between Isaac and Rebecca is, why is it important? Okay, we get it. Isaac, at this point, is somewhat passive. And Rebecca is very active. Isaac is somewhat absent. Rebecca is forever present, forever responsive in the scene. Isaac is quiet, and Rebecca speaks. Danny, sorry. Danny, you need to go to Daddy now.
Okay.
Sorry. There's a young, thank you. There's a young interloper in the room. So why? Why lay it so thick for us? Why put the emphasis so very strongly here at this point? Perhaps to understand that, you know, we started with a question of why this scene marks a change in Isaac. Now we have the question of why this scene shapes Isaac and Rebecca as opposites. Perhaps the second answer, the second question answers the first, and the first answer the second. And I will take a step back and explain. We watch a man who is passive, who is shaped by others, and somehow this man is supposed to pick up the mantle of his father's mission in the world and lead it forward after his father's death. How? How is he supposed to do that? How can he find it? How can he, who is a follower, find it within himself to take initiative and take his father's covenant and lead with it and bring it into the world? How can he, who is preoccupied with the past, with his mother's death, with his brother, look ahead and do what it takes to shape reality moving forward? On the most basic level, and we will keep going deeper and deeper, on the most basic level, what Rebecca brings to him, as we see highlighted through the differences between them in this particular scene of their first encounter, is the spirit of initiative that he himself until this point lacks. We can almost say that she adds a component into the family that he will require moving forward. We can even say something more than that. And here I am quoting Rabbanita Yael Ziegler, who gave a beautiful analysis in a lesson once of this, of Isaac's role amongst the patriarchs. She pointed out that if Isaac was an original thinker, like his father was, an iconoclast, a rebel, someone who opens new paths, he would never have been able to pass on Abraham's legacy. to pass on a legacy, someone needs to be able to shape themselves to be first and foremost a follower. First and foremost, someone who passes things on, not creating new things of their own. The problem, of course, is that Abraham's legacy is twofold. We have the content of the legacy, the covenant, God's edicts, our willingness to engage in relationship with God. To pass on this particular content, Isaac needs to accept it from his father and follow, not start something new. But the second part of Abraham's legacy is his spirit of rebellion, is his refusal to accept any status quo. Without this very important component of Abraham's legacy, the covenant can become petrified, atrophied, like stone. That's what I'm trying to say. It can become stone. It can become out of sync. It can become corrupt. We need to pass both the covenant and a certain refusal to accept the way things are and a certain willingness to change things and renew things all the time. How can one man, Isaac, do both? In order to pass on the covenant, he needs to be a follower. In order to pass on Abraham's innovative spirit, he needs to not be a follower, to be an original thinker. How can one man do it? And this is where Rebecca, shaped thoroughly as his mirror image, comes into the picture, enabling him, not alone, but rather as part of a family, part of a couple, to pass on both sides of Abraham's legacy to the next generation. And yet, I feel that even saying that is not digging deep enough into what actually happens in this scene. Because what actually happens in this scene is not just the addition of Rebecca to the household. It's not just her bringing her spirit into the mix that will be Isaac and Rebecca, first family to be formed under God's covenant, moving and passing on Abraham's legacy to the world. We're going to see more than that. What really happens here, it's not just Rebecca's mechanical kind of union with Isaac, but rather a change, an evolution, a transformation in Isaac himself. Let's go back to the verses and see it for ourselves. I'm going all the way up again to box two, to the last verse, verse 67. Isaac then brought her into the tent of his mother, Sarah. The first time we see him taking an active role here. And he took Rebecca as his wife. Isaac loved her. In Hebrew, it's vayehaveh, which means a little bit more active. It's like came to love her. And thus found comfort after his mother's death. The text tells us quite explicitly that it wasn't only that Rebecca joined him, is that he himself changed. The boy was preoccupied with fields and wells, with his mother's burial and his brother's banishment. The man was bound by his past and by his father's legacy, is now comforted after his mother's death. He makes a choice to bring this new wife into his mother's tent, to replace his mother, his past, with a new future. And this choice wrought emotional change in him on two levels. First, love, and then freedom, comfort, being liberated from his immense preoccupation with what he lost, with what came before. In a way, this short verse is shaped almost as, in a sense, thank you, Danny, honey. I need you to go.
Okay, sweetheart.
Thank you. Sorry. Honey. Thank you very much. Can you bring this to Danny, please?
I want to one of your...
Anyway.
I want to one of your parents.
One moment. Excuse me for a second. I will... Please go to Danny now.
From where this was...
Excuse me. Just a moment. Thank you. These are COVID days. Please excuse me. Moving on. This emotional change, this scene where Isaac brings his wife in and then loves her and then is free, is almost a variation on the very first encounter between spouses that we ever saw in the Hebrew Bible, the encounter between Adam and Eve. Because immediately after we saw that encounter, and we talked about it at length at the time, but here I have it again in box 10. Immediately after we saw that encounter, the biblical commentator, the biblical editor, almost a biblical storyteller, intervenes with an editorial comment saying, handsome man leaves his father and mother and clings to his wife so that they become one flesh. And at the time when we discussed this comment, we pointed out that it doesn't actually fit the narrative when we talk about Adam and Eve, because how can we talk about Adam as having a father and a mother? But what we did see was Adam, whose original name Adam is connecting him to the Adama, the soil from which he came, changing his name to Ish, naming himself after the Isha that he also names after himself. It's like he names himself and the Isha after each other, making him, his name match not his past, not his origins, but rather the future he chooses to pursue. And then it makes a lot more sense, this comment, because what we hear here, hence, namely in future generations, just as Adam had to let go of the Adama, of his origins, to cling onto his wife, the Isha, and become hers, so a man will leave his father and mother and cling to his wife so that they can become one flesh. Except with Yitzhak, the order is changed. He doesn't leave his father and mother. He doesn't fully let go. Yitzhak doesn't fully let go of his preoccupation with his mother and her loss until he clings onto a wife, becomes one flesh with her, comes to love her, and then can leave his father and mother, can become liberated from the shadow cast by his parents, by his brother, by the drama of his birth family, and the many ways it exerts repressing presence on his life. As if in order to highlight it, I want to point out that the very symbols or the very locations, the settings that in our scene mark Isaac as preoccupied with his past, the sadeh, the be'el, the field and the well, later in Isaac's life become symbols of his own initiative, of his own success at leading his own life. He will, moving forward, become the man who sows a field and receives an amazing return. I am here in box 4. Isaac sowed in that land and reaped 100-fold the same year. The Lord blessed him, and the man grew richer and richer until he was very wealthy. Same thing will happen with wells. We will later see Isaac first redigging, dug anew, the wells which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham. And then he goes on to dig his own wells from verse 19. But when Isaac's servants digging in the wadi found there a well spring water, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac, herdsmen saying the water is ours, et cetera, et cetera. And he just goes on and digs more and more and more wells, well past whatever riches of wells or array of wells his father left in the world. Yes, he is the man who continues his father's legacy, but he doesn't just mindlessly carry it on. He makes his own decisions, shapes his own life. And it's as if this one encounter, and especially its ending, the moment when he takes Rebecca and becomes liberated from the past, from his loss, from his grief, is what unlocks Isaac's potential, unlocks what fields and wells can mean for him beyond tying him to a past, and starts pursuing his future. And in that sense, it's very fitting or very necessary for this scene to be the watershed moment between passive Isaac and active Isaac, between the narrative as Abraham's story and as Isaac's story, and between the covenant as one man's unique relationship with God to a relationship that can then be bequeathed from generation to generation to generation, perhaps not through one person, but definitely through the family. Now, this scene, so far I showed all the beautiful things it foreshadows. There are also things about it that are dangerous, that are seeds of alarm, that will explode into fuller scope later. Before I point that out, though, I will take some of your questions, and then we will finish with a tun-tun-tun, the scary tun-tun-tun. Yes, Ruchama, you wanted to say something?
Yes, when you explained, when you were talking about this character of Yitzhak, I just wanted to mention that since the Akedah, he was damaged for life.
Mm-hmm.
Since the Akedah, he is the only one that could not leave the state of Israel, is the only one that somebody else has to find a wife for him, is the only one, he was damaged for life. And it really took a while until he could, the right woman can little by little bring him back to be a man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree to some extent, Ruchama, in the sense that, first of all, I think it's definitely a powerful reading. I don't know that I think it's necessary. I mean, you can read it like that, or you can say that during the Akedah, because we don't see him as very active before the Akedah also, you could say that the Akedah kind of crystallized this passivity within him and made it more acute and really made it tied to trauma.
Yeah,
and not just to his own personality. It is a terrible experience.
That your own father want to kill you or whatever, mm-hmm. whatever you will call it. It really would damage him forever, you know? It was not...
Mm-hmm.
Even
no, I think it's
He was 37 years old at this time, and he could not... He could say, I don't want.
Mm-hmm.
Leave me alone. I don't want, you know? But he mm-hmm. did it. And but he really was damaged.
Yeah, there's a certain self-negation involved in the Akedah. It's hard to even contemplate. Thank you. Thank you for this comment. Jennifer Malvin, you wanted to say something? Just please unmute yourself.
Yes. Thank you. You are just wonderful. I wondered, and I love when your son shows up, so don't stress over that. Question, if you want to skip it, don't worry about it. What significance do you attach to the order of events when it says Isaac brings Rebecca into the tent,
mm-hmm.
right? And then that whole series, and then loved her. You know that I had mm-hmm. I'd actually made a note here. Yeah, he mm-hmm. brings her into the tent, then marries her, then loves her. I wondered why it isn't that he loves her, brings her into the tent, you know, or marries her. Why that order?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. Obviously, I can't give a comprehensive answer to this. I can just offer my understanding based on my reading of the text and what I learned from, you know, traditional and less traditional commentary. You know, when my teacher used to harp about how you can love someone after marriage, it was very obnoxious for me as a teenage girl. But the truth is, they're right, right? Even loving someone before marriage and loving someone after marriage is not the same kind of love. Anyone who had ever had a committed relationship can testify to that love changes. And it's becomes less about will they not, and more about we are together in it. And now we're forming the, you know, kind of bread and butter of this relationship. But I think that here we see something a little deeper than that kind of truism that my teachers kept trying unsuccessfully to ram down our throat. What we're seeing here is Isaac coming to love her after bringing her into the core of his trauma, into the place where he's alone, where he's a motherless boy. And that's why I think the location is emphasized, because it ties to the end, to his feeling of comfort for his mother's death. He brings her into the sanctuary of his vulnerability. And that's where their marriage and love can take place. And there's something very intimate and powerful about that image. Okay, let's take one more question for now, and then I'm willing to stay a little late and answer more questions after, but I do want to get to that one other point first. So, Seema.
Thank you. I was just wondering if you could comment on this. I'm wondering if the preoccupation that Yitzchak had with Sarah, being that he brought her into the tent and he was comforted, and that kind of ended his preoccupation. I was wondering if Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11 in the next perek, expresses the same thing to us about Yishmael. Vayehi acharei mot Avraham, vayevarech Elokim et Yitzchak b'no, vayeshev Yitzchak im be'er lechai ro'i. I'm wondering if that vayeshev is that he's not wandering anymore in that be'er and being preoccupied. He's somewhat settled.
I didn't think about that, but I think it's a great reading. I think that definitely can match. The sages, by the way, have this theory. It's kind of a interpretation that they read into the text, where they say that after Sarah's death, when we hear after Yitzchak's marriage, we hear that Abraham remarried a woman named Ketuah. And the sages say it's not Ketuah, it's Hagar. It's Ishmael's mother. And it was Yitzchak who went back and brought her for his father, kind of healing that chasm that tore his family apart. And I mean, it's not the pshat, and we are here dealing with a basic text, but I don't mind commenting that I feel like Chazal, the sages here, are coming from the same kind of interpretive impulse as we've been following in this class, that Isaac is only traumatized until this scene. Until this scene, he's preoccupied with the loss. He's preoccupied with the past. But after this scene, he acts. He does things about it. He brings a different wife or the same wife to his mother. He settles down by that, well, kind of decisively, out of his own initiative. He takes his life into his own hands. I will take more questions past the time of the class, but I want to be able to make the final point before people have to leave, to be fair to everybody. So I just want to make one more point about this scene. We discussed at length all kinds of things that are in this scene. But if you look carefully, you will notice that there's one thing that is glaringly missing from this scene. And what's missing is any sort of dialogue between Isaac and Rebecca themselves. Rebecca does some things, Isaac does some things. Where is the communication between them? There's no communication whatsoever. If anything, there's an act of veiling, a literal act of veiling, where Rebecca draws the veil over her face. Instead of seeing the closeness of people sharing their internal worlds, what we're seeing here is Isaac undergoing a very significant transformation, but there's a veil, both literal and verbal, a veil of silence separating the two. Now, just to clarify, I'm not saying they never talk to each other. I'm just saying that the fact that the storyteller showing them talking to each other is significant. And part of why it's significant is that in later parts of the story, we will see this failure of communication coming to the fore time and time and time again. And when down the line, we will discuss that scene at great length next week, Rebecca sees her husband about to give blessings to what she sees as the wrong son. She doesn't go and talk to him like Sarah did with Abraham when she felt cheated. She doesn't complain to him as Rachel will do to her son Jacob. And that we will discuss in 2 weeks, I believe. What she does instead is go behind his back and deceive him instead of communicating with him plainly. In fact, the first time in the entire Isaac and Rebecca relationship that we see Rebecca talking to her husband will be after the theft of the blessings, and it will be a lie, or at least a lie of omission. Because what Rebecca will say is this, I'm in the last box. Rebecca said to Isaac, I am disgusted with my life because of the Hittite women. that is the Hittite women that Esav married. If Jacob marries a Hittite woman like these from among the native women, what good will life be to me? Now, the sentiment itself is honest. The text already tells us elsewhere that Rebecca hates the Hittite women and that it brings great bitterness to her life that her son Esav married local women, local idolatrous women. But the way she shares it with Yitzhak here is a manipulation, because her purpose in this scene, and we will see that again next week, we will revisit it more at length, is to get Jacob out of the house. She overhears Esav planning to murder Jacob because of the theft of the blessing that she initiated and orchestrated. She tells Jacob, you should leave, go to my brother's house so you don't get killed. But in order to get Yitzhak to send his son, she doesn't tell him the truth. She doesn't tell him, your favorite son, Esav, threatened to kill your other son, Jacob. She tells him this truth that's also a lie, that the reason to send Jacob is for marriage, not to save his life, and motivates Yitzhak to follow through with sending Jacob away. So the one time we do see them actually communicating, the veil that separates them remains in place. Now, why is that? There's many theories. Maybe, as Rashi believes, it's because Rebecca was very much in awe of Isaac. We saw in the beginning how she falls from the camels when she sees him. So she didn't feel that she can bring her concerns to him. Maybe it was because they were so different. And those differences, the very differences that made them a good couple for carrying the legacy, Abraham's twofold legacy, and made her a catalyst for Isaac's transformation into a man who can take initiative. Maybe these very beneficial differences are exactly the thing that makes it difficult for them to communicate across their differences. We don't know. The storyteller doesn't tell us. But this failure of communication stands, is present in the story, and we will unpack it and its impact on their children in our next time. So first of all, thank you, everybody. I will take a few more of the questions in the chat now as far as I can. I can't stay for very long, but if anybody needs to leave, thank you very much, and it was wonderful to see you.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Raquel, just one cute note. First of all, it's good to hear your kids. You can bring them on screen so we can say hello to them. That's fine, especially now. But it's very interesting. A couple of weeks ago, Rivka Freundlich in the Parsha Shir gave her whole Parsha Shir on the comparison between Avram and Rivka. She established that was her shir. So it's always nice to see. Anyways, I figured I'd just let you know that. And now you can take a look at the questions in the chat box.
Okay, just a moment. I was asked by Ilana Lubin, technical question, what translation do you use for your Tanakh sources? So I'll be honest, I'm not such a connoisseur, since the English is not my first language. I'm not, I just take whatever Sepharia offers me. I'm not sure what it is.
She's coming to the Monday class. We have a Monday class all on translation, so it's a big deal. We've learned how the importance of every translation.
So I'll be honest and just say whatever Sepharia offers, I take. And that's why I make a point of sometimes saying I prefer to translate it like this or like that. I really like the Robert Alter translation for literary purpose. Like, he captures a lot of the literary nuance of the text, but it's less. Sometimes the artistry, I feel, comes at the expense of some of the plainer meanings. So I don't use it so much for this. Moment. Okay, there's a lot of great comments and questions. I just don't have time to answer all of them. I apologize. I'll go back to the comment that Rebecca Rottenberg made in the very, very beginning of the class, where she pointed out that while it says that Isaac loves Rebecca, it does not say that Rebecca loved it. This is true, and this is important, and it creates a certain imbalance in the description. It is important, though, to see it in context. And the context is that the Torah never tells us that a woman loved her husband, ever. And the entire Hebrew Bible tells us of one case of a woman who loved her husband. Does anybody happen to know who it was?
Michal.
Exactly. Exactly. Michal, whose love did not go very well for her, to be honest. So while it's important to note that Rebecca doesn't love Yitzhak, it's also important to take it in context and recognize that it's not something unique about their relationship that means that they are, that they are somehow particularly imbalanced or especially imbalanced, because this is just a fairly standard perspective from the point of view of the Bible. Okay, unfortunately, the cute little hooligans got a little bit of a mix from. Yes.
Just, Rachel, if you'd like, you can begin next week by addressing some of these questions if you'd like. If you want to spend a few minutes, that's, you know, that's up to you. So you don't have to really have to do them now, but you don't have to necessarily ignore them either.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just want to point out, somebody asked if I can put my email in the chat. I did. People are welcome to write to me. And on that note, thank you, everybody. It was a pleasure being with you today, and have a wonderful rest of the week.
Thank you. Enjoy the kids. Okay. Have a good day. Thank you, everybody. Okay, tomorrow, Rav Carmel, David HaMelech, Bivrit, Be'achad V'Rabba, B'Tzoraim, and then at 8:30 tomorrow night, Moshe Sokolov continuing his series, How Tanakh Was Put Together. Thursday, Shuli Mishkin continuing her series, and then Rav Gedalia Berger will be giving the Parsha of the Shavuot here, and then my share in the Siddur Friday morning. Okay, we look forward to learning with you. Everybody have a wonderful day, and all good things. Be well. Thank you. Bye-bye.